When I was in my 20s, I spent a fair amount of time in yoga schools, and when I was in my 30s, I spent a goodly amount of time in yoga ashrams. And there was a point along that continuum when it became almost inevitable that I would become certified as a yoga instructor. That was not an uncommon course of action for women in my particular demographic. During those years, many of us who had a deepening devotion to yogic practices saw certification as the next step in our spiritual development, not necessarily as a career choice. Besides, my flexibility and hypermobility made me a yoga adept. The style of yoga that I practiced was quite traditional. There were swamis and gurus who taught us wearing saffron robes. We did hatha yoga following a set sequence of classical postures. The texts we studied were equal parts life manual and Vedantic philosophy. The chants we sang were in the original Sanskrit, and we had learned what they meant. Though my class came from various religious backgrounds, there was no question that we were devotees within a Hindu tradition. So I should not have been as confounded as I was when, at the conclusion of my training, I was asked to choose a spiritual name from among the gods and goddesses in the Hindu pantheon to complete my initiation into the rank of Yoga Shiromani. The selections students made were always highly gendered, and so the majority of female students took the lyrical names of lovely goddesses. Lakshmi, the goddess of prosperity, Saraswati, the goddess of learning, and Parvati, the goddess of beauty. These seemed a little too perfect to me, too foreign to my own experience. I did not feel as pulled together or accomplished as all that, despite my training. When I formally requested to take my spiritual name from the goddess Kali, however, I got called in for a conversation. Those of you familiar with the Hindu pantheon will know that Kali is the least picturesque goddess of all. She is not pretty. Rather, she is ferocious. While she wears a crown, she is usually depicted with wildly disheveled hair and elongated tongue that she pushes outside her mouth, sometimes between the fangs she has grown, holding aloft a sword that is shown dripping blood. In Hindu mythology, she is both demon slayer and warrior queen. And interestingly, the special power she enshrines is time itself. Exasperated by this 11th hour selection of mine, this curious selection of mine, my instructor insisted, "You are nothing like Kali. Why choose Kali at all? Because it sounds like your name?" While it's true that Kelly and Kali sound a lot alike, that was not my rationale. My deepest sense was that any spiritual practice worth cultivating would help us to slay a few demons, at least. The demons within ourselves, the despondency, the jealousy, the resentment, as well as the demons in the wider world, the cruelty, the injustice, the greed. And that we could count on encountering both sorts of demons rather routinely. Reluctantly, then, my request was granted, and I was given the spiritual name Kali, which I used for the briefest period imaginable. The name that was given to me was written on my yoga mat, but hardly ever spoken. In my short term as a yoga instructor, I taught homeless women and inner city school children exclusively. And I would not have dared to ask them to call me by anything but my given name. They were confronting all kinds of demons themselves with surprising degrees of success. And it was their struggles I wanted to honor, not mine. Over time, my yoga practices have shifted, and now that I'm in my late 40s, they bear little resemblance to the one I kept a few decades ago. I can no longer slip into the scorpion pose I once did almost effortlessly, and honestly, that's no longer a personal ambition of mine. Yoga is both a more modest and more meaningful practice to me lately, and the parts of my training that remain the most formative were the ones that gave me glimpses into how multifaceted various forms of spiritual practice are, and indeed ought to be. As the Reverend Eric Walker Wickstrom writes in his compendium, Faithful Practices, Everyday Ways to Feed Your Spirit, if the purpose of spirituality is to help you live an awake, truly alive life, then you must approach your spiritual practice in an awake and truly alive way. Over the coming 3 months at UU Wellesley Hills, Joan and I will be leading a congregational book study of faithful practices, which are available for purchase either in the UUA In Spirit bookstore or online. And it is divided into 3 distinct sections. First, those practices born in tradition. Second, those practices born in play. And finally, those practices born in daily life. Of course, no day is exactly like the one before it, and no one is exactly like the day after it, not in any of our lives. And so it is worth doing an occasional survey of what we need for the days that we have been given. Each January, I encourage all of you to plan on an annual spiritual. And again, we have questionnaires available outside in the vestibule for you to take. You might want to discuss the answers with a friend from your Touchstone group, or with one of our pastoral companions, perhaps, or a minister here. In addition to that, however, I invite all of you to come to as many of these book study sessions as you possibly can. In Faithful Practices, the Reverend Wickstrom notes the differing taxonomies of spiritual practice, apart from those 3 outlined in the table of contents. He himself delineates 8 spheres of spiritual practice, while another author tallies 4 varieties in the later chapter. And today I won't burden you with catalogs of either of those, because I agree with Wickstrom when he concludes that in the end, everything can be considered either an interior practice that draws you inward to deep personal reserves, or an exterior practice that brings you back outward into broader engagement with the world beyond yourself. Both are necessary to our fullest possible spiritual development and for the flourishing of our common humanity. Rest assured that the distressing headlines you are reading appear in my news feed too. Like you, I am painfully aware of the wildfires raging in Australia and the 2020 election cycle coming up soon in America. Some of you tell me that you cannot put these things out of your mind. Take whatever actions your conscience prompts you to in moments such as these, and by all means, take them as immediately as possible. Yet we all need ways of finding our individual still points in the cross currents of contemporary events, and we can most certainly help one another to find those too. Understand that I am not asking you to forget any of the tragic specifics here. However, I am asking you to remember the greater reality in which they all reside, whether you call that Atman or God or the universe. Remember those, and then remind one another of it whenever and however you can. We are not only at the start of a new year, but at the start of an entirely new decade, and I'd venture to guess a new era in human history as well. Given how much uncertainty confronts us, it is entirely natural for us to feel disoriented, tentative, or frightened. Still, as the poet Edwin Meir observes, the way leads on, the way leads on. One of the most profound insights I got as a yoga student examining Vedantic philosophy was this cosmic sense of time that the greatest sages understood. Time could be neither arrested nor accelerated. It could only unfold into its own expanse at its own pace. Later today, we'll have a lunch discussion about how to celebrate our 150th anniversary as a congregation, and it is a worthy milestone for us to mark our sesquicentennial. It matters very much that people in the past planned for a future, but I am struck by how little they actually knew of what the future would hold. Earlier this week, a thoughtful member of UU Wellesley Hills dropped off in the church offices a framed copy of the original charter granted us by the Commonwealth of Massachusetts. It establishes this church for general religious purposes, a phrase that strikes me as both quaint and baffling. Do general religious purposes exist, even? Universal ones might, but general ones? The religious practices of the 19th century evolved into the religious practices of the 20th, which evolved into the religious practices of the 21st, very near the dawn of the millennium, where we find ourselves now. The human spirit has an intense interest in both the temporal and the eternal, I have noticed. And when it is actively in discernment, it becomes all the easier for us to let the older forms fade away and let newer forms emerge as they will. With practice, we allow those organic shifts with less mental anguish and minimal collective anxiety. Successful spiritual disciplines let people simultaneously remember and forget our place in creation. That guru who reincarnated as a pig in our story for all ages this morning managed to do both things across his lifetimes, much to his credit. In yogic teaching, we recognize that successive stages and stations in life make different spiritual demands and issue different ethical requirements. The challenging part is that as soon as we master one stage, we have nearly arrived at the next. So the skills that serve each of us as a student will not necessarily suit our life when we become what yogis call a householder, either one who maintains or else supports a household and the family it holds. Householders eventually have empty nests and then need to think about the commitments they will make during their periods of retirement, after which they may be asked to consider becoming still more sage and philosophical about surrendering their personal interests in the world. These stages are considered a perfectly natural progression in human development. The passage from that Sanskrit hymn, the Rig Veda, that contained our call to worship today declares, "Common be our resolution, common be our deliberations, common be our intentions." But our approaches to ultimate concerns need never be uniform. The varieties of Hindu deities and devotions are manifold and at times mind-boggling. Similarly, styles of yoga appeal to varying personalities with certain broad categories. Some personalities will be immediately drawn to intellectual inquiry, others to heartfelt expression, still others to tireless service, and still other to holistic methods of integration. All these paths are valid, provided they are undertaken with a degree of dedication. My hope for everyone here is that you are walking one now, or in the process of finding your way to it. We Unitarian Universalists are known for a certain spiritual eclecticism, and that has its merits, so long as we honor one another's private devotions and encourage one another to practice, practice, practice. In Faithful Practices, the Reverend Sue McGidson, a hospital chaplain and community minister, offers us these words in her chapter on prayer. May you find spiritual practices that support you on your journey through all that life throws your way. May these practices help you to live the life you yearn for, to become your best self, to walk your talk. May you find the courage to experiment with new spiritual practices, particularly those that seem awkward and uncomfortable at first, trying them on to see what fits. May your spiritual practices evolve and grow with you, blessing you all the days of your life. May this be so for all of us here today. May your practices help you to live an awake, truly alive life, leading you, as one piece of sacred Sanskrit scripture explains it, from the unreal to the real. Believe that it is right and fitting for your spiritual practices to morph as you do, and indeed, as our whole world does. Over the years in cities up and down the Northeastern Corridor, I've had a considerable rotation of yoga mats, different colors, different thicknesses, different materials. Earlier this week, on an earth hugger mat upstairs in my bedroom, I noticed bits of blue coming up with me as I performed my sun salutation. The time was coming for me to recycle this particular mat, obviously. As I began rolling it up, I saw written in permanent marker, Kali, with quotation marks around it. I laughed at the obviously ambivalent younger me who put my spiritual name in quotes, because Kali is and is not my name. Even today, Kali is and is not my name. I embody my past self and future self in my present person, and that is a paradox I have learned to accept, as all of us must at some point in our life. Kali is such a fearsome goddess because she reigns over that unruly realm of tenacious time. Because Kali keeps stride with it in a way that is strong and courageous, because she expects demons and triumphs to appear in seemingly endless succession. She has no quarrel with paradox, which is perhaps the part of her I love the most. The best spiritual practices let each of us straddle change and constancy, the enduring and the ephemeral, with a surprising amount of flexibility and a degree even of balance and equanimity. When we experience this, the world has the chance to observe it. The Sanskrit word for yoga has a meaning that is translated as to yoke. I want for all of us here to be yoked and to feel yoked to our practices, to our commitments, to one another, to this faith community, and to our common hopes for the world. Only when we are so yoked do we stand a chance at that spiritual freedom which we will need to face the time.